I mean, to my point of view, they gave us some decent music. They gave us, you know, the idea of free love, I guess, or you could get naked at a concert and smoke some weed, but that's it.
Yeah, and you know, you have to take the good with the bad. So the Bee Gees are boomers too. So you know, you got to take the disco with the rock and roll. And they didn't invent rock and roll anyway.
That is true.
I'm Ben White, and this is Baby Bust, a series about the baby boomers and the legacy that they're leaving the rest of us. So I'm Generation X, and I've got a lot of complaints about the baby boomers, and I've had them for years.
Typical Xer, you're saying, oh yeah, they gave us, you know, diet foods and yoga.
And we're going to use this podcast to try to figure out what was good about the baby boom, not so good about the baby boom, whether I'm unfair in the way I feel about this generation and what they've left to the rest of us and the world.
I know there's a myth that all the baby boomers are retiring fat and happy, but the reality in America is that a lot of people are not.
Or whether I should take it more easy on the baby boom, and in fact, maybe they did some good things.
Boomers gave younger generations a language of communitarianism and holism that they are going to use when it comes time to bind this country back together again.
What we want to try to figure out is, okay, so the baby boomers clearly left us with some big structural problems.
So we have the pensions, we have Social Security, we have the national debt.
On the debt, on economic inequality, on the environment.
Deferred maintenance and infrastructure. Deferred maintenance is a BS word. That just means we didn't do anything about it.
So who's going to fix all of this? Is it left to Gen Z? Is it left to millennials? Can Gen X play a role here in helping fix some of these problems?
Okay, fine. We're going to deal. Everybody's going to hate us. We're like the dad who's going to turn the car around.
100%.
That's who we've become.
Does the baby boom have one last shot to try and contribute to fixing some of these structural problems? Or are we really turning over leadership to new generations, millennials, Gen Z?
I don't know. I think we're Gen Z.
To say, okay, baby boomers, you screwed us in pretty significant ways, and here's what we're going to do to fix it. I mean, sometimes I think that, you know, nothing is going to change until the baby boomers are all dead.
That's bleak, man. No, no.
Gen X, baby, I'm bleak. It's all bleak.
Well, maybe I got to be the sunny millennial here, but again, I see
bring it.
A lot of boomers cheering us on.
Today, though, I'm looking at problems that we're left with. I'm going to talk to fellow Gen Xer Bruce Gibney.
Thank you for having me.
Author of A Generation of Sociopaths.
I'm not arguing that all boomers are sociopaths or, you know, that the clinical diagnosis fits any one individual. But as a political class, their behaviors are sociopathic. They're sort of not prudent. We can see this in the debt and the savings rates. They have a sort of severe lack of empathy as policymakers. We can see this in their treatment of immigrants and students who have to pay, you know, increasingly high fees and have sort of Merchant of Venice student lenders. We can see this in their sort of neglect of infrastructure, climate, Social Security, and so on. You know, they're fairly hostile people. I think the current administration sort of more or less proves that point.
Okay. All right. Let's just set the stakes and get into the meat of this, which is specifically, how did the baby boom generation break America?
So I think the sort of overarching rubric is you know, you can look at the world in two ways, as a zero-sum game and as a positive-sum game. If it's positive-sum, we can all work together and as a society and everyone will mutually sort of benefit. We can. If it's a zero-sum game, you really just play for yourself. There's nothing to be created. There's only things to be taken. And society really doesn't have a role to play. Except as perhaps an expedient mechanism for funneling wealth to you. And I think the sense of social solidarity that prevailed, for example, in the World War II era and immediately after, has been essentially vaporized by the boomers. You can think of it really as the boomers had a social credit card and they really ran up the debt. And the debt is not just the national debt, which is going to exceed its World War II peak in the next decade. And of course, we have not beaten the Nazis or done any, you know, had a Marshall Plan or anything like that. We have Mar-a-Lago, I guess.
We did beat the Russians in the arms race, right? I mean, we did do that.
Well, I think the Russians beat themselves, really. It was never a tenable system to begin with, but you know, I'll give them, you know, some credit for that. But of course, really, it's Reagan, Thatcher, and Gorbachev who bring it to a conclusion, and they are not boomers. So I'm not going to throw too many pennies in their direction on that one. So we have the pensions, we have Social Security, we have the national debt, we have what's called deferred maintenance in infrastructure. Deferred maintenance is a BS word that just means we didn't do anything about it. That's another $4 trillion. We, of course, have climate, which has been a known problem since the 80s. The evidence became sort of extremely compelling in the 90s. Nothing's been done about that. We have an R&D deficit. Even the military has been run down. You know, this is sort of a bipartisan critique. You know, sort of normally from the left, you don't sort of think of the military as an asset, but in fact, it is an asset. And you know, on the fiscal side of things, I think the true national debt is probably something like $26-28 trillion against a $21 trillion economy. And then you have sort of you know, subtler things. Obviously, the defunding of the public universities and the sort of concomitant rise in student debt, which is a real burden on younger people. They really just can't start families in sort of the traditional way with anything approaching the ease of the boomers. You know, UC Berkeley and you know, the 50s and 60s, you know, tuition was $300. I'm not even going to bother to inflation adjust it. It just wasn't that much, right? And that's just not the case anymore.
Let's go back to how the boomers became this way, what made them this way. And let's talk about the world that they grew up in versus generations before them. And I'm thinking obviously of the, you know, the greatest generation, World War II generation, and the silent generation after them. A very different experience if you were a boomer. So let's first define the years we're talking about of their birth, the baby boom generation, and then what their life was like growing up in America.
Sure. So the boom is conventionally defined as people born between 1946 and 1964. If you look at the demographics, there's actually sort of the boom starts earlier in 1940 and it starts petering out around 1960. So your peak boomer is in the early 1950s. And by the way, these are basically all the presidential candidates and so forth. The people running Congress still. We're still, I mean, the recycling of names is ridiculous. Biden, Warren, Bloomberg, Clinton, you know, et cetera. But what made them this way? So it was sort of multi-factor. You know, the first thing obviously is that they were born into a world that was prosperous. So even the people, you know, who were born in, like, let's say 1942. So the assumption, sort of, if you're a younger person, everything is working, is that, you know, that's just the way that things are, and you don't really have to invest a lot of effort in this. But we don't live in a frictionless world. You know, inertia doesn't carry you forever. But that lesson they didn't fully internalize. There are a couple of sort of quirkier factors which I think played a role. One, television. It's television is not good for you. That's, you know, at least as a young person, that's just the sort of academic consensus. The first mass-produced television comes out in 1946, so that's just in time for the boom. By the 60s, 90% of households have them. There are a couple other sort of quirky things. A real historical one-off. They're the first and only generation to be bottle-fed instead of breast-fed. So up to 75% of them were bottle-fed, and now today it's 75% are breast-fed. That has been shown to have sort of negative impacts on sort of cognitive function and personality development. There are other factors that are floating around sort of in there. Obviously, Vietnam had an effect on them, and that was specifically age-based, right, because of the draft. There were other sort of quirky things that both reflected and interplayed with boomer power, like the lowering of the drinking age, again, sort of specifically age-based and so on, and the lowering of the voting age.
You do point this out in the book that you really are talking mainly about, you know, white middle-class boomers, but you say not all boomers directly participated, almost all benefited. They are, as the law would have it, jointly and severally liable. So is no one off the hook here from the boomer generation?
Not financially. They shouldn't be. And I think you're starting to see this in the policy responses of the younger people who were recently elected. It's the older people who are the wealthy people, you know, Silicon Valley sort of accepted. And these responses, these wealth taxes, the Green New Deal, which obviously involves a massive increase in taxation and what have you, these are all sort of tacit generational responses. And I think it's politically infeasible, but it would be good if we could be a bit more honest about sort of why we're doing these things. You know, one, you know, we do need to remediate the climate, but two, we also need to charge the people who on whose watch, you know, these sort of disasters really accelerated. someone's got to pay. We all, you know, given the size of the bill, we're all going to have to pay. But I think the boomers should pay more than anyone else. It's sort of, you know, that's just the way it is.
All right. So we talked about this a little bit, particularly as it regards civil rights, and the boomers love to take credit for changes in the civil rights laws. And as you mentioned, they were actually quite young when all of that happened. But talk to a boomer and they will immediately start talking about Woodstock. They'll start talking about the social revolution. They'll start talking about the fact, you know, that you had more rights for women and LGBT rights and people with disabilities. There is a great fetishization among that generation of, you know, some of the social revolution that happened under their watch. What kind of credit, if any, do they get for that stuff?
Some, you know, things are better. But if you look at the landmarks again, so desegregation, that's not boomer, that's 54. You know, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, those are 64, 65. And obviously, it's a boomer court that's busily unwinding the Voting Rights Act. You know, for women, Title IX, that's an extension of the 60s Act in 1972, sponsored by two people who were born in 1927. So those aren't boomers. What is noticeable, for example, is that, so, you know, boomers are, you know, entering the corner office in the 90s and really sort of firmly in control, is that that happens to actually be the point at which wage equality between the sexes stalls out, right? And so these are the people who have, you know, they're in control of the companies. They can say, you know, listen, you know, whoever's doing the work, you know, same work, same pay, $1, $1. It's actually, it's the easiest mathematical calculation you can make. And they chose not to do it. So, and then of course there's Trump, right? Who is, you know, sort of no one's example of, you know, sort of radical sort of civil and social sort of, you know, empathy. And we know sort of what generation sort of tilted his way. So, yes, of course, you know, of course things are better. You know, it's better now to be sort of minority of any description, virtually any description. Transgender in the military, obviously, with Trump, that's less, you know, but so they do get some credit, but the biggest strides were made by prior generations. This is sort of like the boomer theme, right? Like, to the extent that the response is, well, you know, we're richer now as a nation than we were in 1950. That's true. But the rate of GDP growth has decelerated. We're a more equal society than we were in 1953. That's true, but the you know, the pace of change has decelerated. There, you know, aside from gay marriage, there is no step function change in civil liberties that's comparable to what happened in the mid-century under the boomers' predecessors. So, yes, they have either out of sort of benign neglect or, you know, sort of mild empathy or light progressivism allowed pre-existing trends to continue. They've done very little to accelerate them and nothing radical to achieve greater equality. And of course, sort of the poster child for this is income and wealth inequality, right, which is massively expanded under the boomer watch. And then the ultimate inequality is intergenerational sort of equality, right? I mean, we're talking about multiple generations in the future. We're not talking about, you know, 30 million, you know, 40 million African Americans or X million sort of gay people or what have you. We're talking about billions of future Americans and also, you know, billions of people around the globe who will be affected by climate change. And that's a massive inequity for which, you know, all of sort of Woodstock and, you know, being slightly less harassy in the office cannot compensate for it. It just can't.
It does sound like when we're talking about the boomers and the wreckage that they left behind, that we are really and truly fucked as a country. And we need the millennials and Gen Z to fix us. Can they do it? And I'm absenting us and Gen X here a little bit because we are a small generation. As you said, we haven't always been that connected. But if you want to throw Gen X's role in here too, that would be good. Can we be saved?
Oh, yes. I mean, all these problems are tractable. Most of them relate to money. You know, even climate is just a question of sort of, you know, like a great, you know, sort of Great Depression, New Deal to Apollo mission kind of sort of decision that we're going to overcome these obstacles. But it is going to require a lot of money and a lot of political skill. I think the millennials are much more focused on sort of, you know, social solidarity. Certainly the rhetoric seems to indicate this. I think the big challenge is not really the money, although everyone's going to have to pay higher taxes. And that includes the middle class, right? So there's this rhetoric that's really developed and intensified over the past 40 years that the middle class always gets tax cuts and everyone else gets soaked somehow. Everyone's going to have to pay more. I think the main impediment right now is because of the, you know, death grip the boomers have had over the political system, there hasn't been a lot of time for younger generations to season themselves in Congress as policymakers and what have you. You know, in terms of managing the machinery of government, understanding policy feedbacks, unintended consequences, and so forth, we don't have a skilled younger political class. And, you know, youth is youth. But, you know, as you know, in your late 20s, early 30s, you know, one would hope that, you know, people had experience of sort of, you know, town councils, being a mayor, a governor of a smaller state, you know, backbench congressman, what have you, because you have to know how to write a law. You have to know how to read a CBO projection. And the boomers have deprived younger people of the opportunity to learn those skills. So I think even if the political will is there, the actual sort of effectuation of well-meaning ideals might not be smoothly handled. But I hope to be proven wrong on that one.
And do you think millennials are politically engaged enough at this point? I mean, we have certain examples like AOC and Pete Buttigieg in Indiana as millennials who are entering the political system and seem to have these ideas that everybody's going to have to pay more and that we can make progress in some of these big structural problems. But are they the exception to the rule of a disengaged millennial who sees no real hope in the political process and, as you say, is not trained for the political process? Are there going to be enough of them, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, there are enough if the voting participation increases, right? So it's incumbent on them to get out and vote in 2020, to run for local office and what have you. And I think they can and they will do it. Time is running out, so let's hope it's 2020, not 2024. I think actually in a weird way, our generation, despite being small and politically disengaged, we might be in a weird way the swing. And the reason why is we're in our peak earning years. And so the bill is going to be presented to us first, and it's going to be substantial. And, you know, we can either ally with the future or we can ally with the past. And given that, you know, every election in the United States appears to be 49.9 to 50.1, it actually does matter how a small generation votes. And we have, you know, sort of more vested interests. The older people are about to retire, be protected by Social Security. Younger people don't have, you know, significant incomes to tax. We do. We might be the sort of swing vote policy-wise. And it's going to be a very, very difficult choice for Gen X because we're not going to live to see our investment recouped. I believe that well-spent dollars by the federal government will lead to a positive return. There's good historical evidence for that, but you and I are going to be dead.
Yeah, I mean, I just thinking about this right now as you talk about it, the idea that Gen X is basically going to have to decide if we are willing to pay higher taxes on our incomes as we're in our peak earning years on just the faith that it will pay off for generations behind us with, you know, better infrastructure and a better funded social safety net. And I don't have any idea what the answer to that question is. My instinct is probably yes, given that, you know, we kind of came of age where there weren't that many great jobs and we had to struggle, you know, to a certain degree, not like the World War II generation struggled, but, you know, it was kind of a shitty economy and we took bad jobs and we did them and we're sort of stoic in doing them and rising up the ladder. I feel, and maybe this is feeling over facts and I'm taking a boomer approach to this, like if Gen X is asked to do that and to vote in favor of candidates who are saying, yes, you're going to have to pay a higher marginal tax rate, even if you're making, you know, $150,000, $200,000, we'll just suck it up and do it. What do you think?
I think that's right. If you look at the voting breakdown, it does seem that the Gen Xers, they're not as progressive and they are, true to a stereotype, more cynical about these things than the millennials, but they do break more with the millennials than they do with the boomers. So I'm fairly hopeful. But I think for this to be really palatable, there has to be a sense of justice. And so when we're asked to pay, we need to know that we're going to get something. You know, we won't live to see, you know, a new interstate highway system or Elon boring tunnels through wherever, or the climate cleaned up. But we need a sense that there will be a reckoning. The boomers need to be swept from power. Social Security, if taxes increase, Social Security must be made solvent indefinitely, right? There must be eventual progress, not in the next 10, 15 years, but there must be eventual progress on the debt. We must have some sense that things are going to get better. And even if we don't experience them ourselves, we must see the trends move in the right direction. And the boomers need to pay their fair share of the tax. And that's going to look disproportionate. It's not disproportionate to what they've gotten, but it's going to look that way. Anything that says, well, you're just too old to have to, to pay for your sins, that's not going to work politically.
Yeah, I got to tell you that I got literal chills when you said that the boomers must be swept from power and the idea that they're going to get exempted from a goddamn thing. No, they're not. If we're going to pay higher taxes to clean up the shit that they left behind, they're going to pay their fair share 100%. And that's why I feel like, there is this, and I don't know if you feel this personally. I wonder if you do, much more kind of emotionally connected to millennials and of the same kind of general worldview. Although, we can all poke fun at millennials for whatever they do on social media or whatever, but I like millennials and get along with millennials in a way I never did with boomers. Like, I have had a hard time in my life. Every time I had a boss or a manager who was a boomer, I could never connect. Like, if it was somebody older who was, silent generation, great simpatico relationship. As soon as it was a boomer, it was just a mess. Like, I just could not navigate it in the same way. I wonder what your experience with that is.
Yeah, that's been basically my experience. They're more optimistic. I have more in common with them. But most importantly, I can have a conversation. They are prepared to entertain, additional sort of, facts. Now, maybe not quite as open-minded as one might like, but then what human being is. But you can have a conversation with them in a way that you can't with boomers, it's just, a person at the end of the table who's regurgitating Fox News tidbits, or even on the left, it's sort of whatever Rachel Maddow has said that day. You can have a more engaged, you can actually have a dialogue with people in our generation and younger people. And there isn't the third rail of Social Security, right? So it does make for a much more honest conversation. And the only honest conversations can be productive. All the rest is just a waste of time and a frivolous social obligation. It's like, yes, of course, we have to fly home, eat the Thanksgiving turkey and pretend, that Uncle So-and-so is in any way tolerable or has anything sort of reasonable or fact-based to say. And I don't have that experience with younger people. Again, not all boomers are like this.
I feel like we need to hashtag not all boomers.
Right. Well, there are certainly probably some boomers who would agree with you.
Thank you.
Sorry. We have a guy who's recording us who's a boomer who probably just wants to punch us both in the face right now. But, what are you going to do? Bruce Gibney is the author of A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America, and a new book, The Nonsense Factory, The Making and Breaking of the American Legal System. Can't recommend them highly enough, particularly if you're a bitter Gen Xer like I am, but if you're anybody who's interested in the future of the country, even a boomer who might not like what they read, please check them out. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. An Xer talking to another Xer about how much they hate baby boomers. Sounds boring. But I did talk to baby boomers for this very series, including Neil Haupt. He's a boomer, and he's the guy who coined the term millennial. And he actually read Bruce Gibney's book.
Yeah, well, great book, and exactly what you'd expect from an Xer, sociopathic generation. Of course, what one might mention is that Xers sort of inherited a lot of those sociopathic traits, right, of extreme individualism and kind of, it works for me attitude, right?
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk to him on our next episode. The episode was produced by Jenny Ament. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. I'm Ben White. Thanks for listening.